Cain and Abel. And yesterday we spoke about the fact that Chava had pretty low expectations from Hevel. Everybody remember that? You know, her main hopes were pinned on Cain, and that's clear from the fact that she gave him a good name, whereas she gave a lousy name to Hevel. So that is led them also when they were dividing up the world on page 20 for Cain to get the optimal position of being a farmer, whereas Hevel got the less satisfying position of having to be a shepherd, right? So that's how things are holding. And it says in the first pasuk on that page, pasuk gimel, vayimiket yomim, and some day after a period of time, it says in our scroll, yomim is not specific. It doesn't really tell us exactly how many days. But I imagine it's after the first year, right? Sometimes it's an afterward yomim, does mean a year. So imagine it's a year, meaning after the first cycle of growth of the crops and of the sheep. So then they came to thank God for what they had received. So Vayomi Kain Mipri Adama Minchol Hashem. So here we see also who goes first? Kain goes first, right? Kain brings his carbon first, the man, right? He brought his Pri Adama, the fruit of the ground, right? As the Mincha as a carbon. Mincha is any sacrifice which is not made out of an animal, but rather it's, you know, flour or such like. So wine is also called a mincha. So I imagine whatever he brought was vegetation, obviously, so that's why it's called a mincha. He brought his mincha to Hashem, right? So, and the pasuk tells, v'hevel hebi gam hu, the stress is, he also ran, right? He also brought, right? V'hevel hebi, he brought gam hu, also he, right? Mincholo sono, from the firstborn of his sheep, and from, how do you translate here, the choices, okay? Chelad literally means the fat. And the fat of sheep are assumed to be the choicest sheep. That's the important point here, right? Which is, this is the first slaughter of an animal, which we find in Tanakh, right? And he said they weren't allowed to eat the animals, right? But nevertheless, they were allowed to bring the animals as sacrifices. This is an interesting milestone in human history. Because beforehand, animals were not meant to be sacrifices. They weren't meant to be eaten, and they weren't even meant to be sacrifices. In the Garden of Eden, animals would have a role to play by their being alive, not just by their being sacrificed, right? Or I should now, I should have said it wrong. Animals had a role to be played, but by being alive and not by being sacrificed. Here, for the first time, animals serve the role to serve mankind in a way that they are sacrificed, their life is eliminated in order for man to serve God. It's a fascinating idea, right? Yeah.
When came at all to the concept of sacrifice? I mean, where in the world did you think there was within the world? I mean, where did the concept of sacrifice come from?
It's a good question. I don't know. It sounds like you made it up.
It's an appreciation.
Yeah, it's a nice thing. Yeah. It's a nice gesture. Maybe it was a spontaneous gesture,
I think. About it. I mean, you give me animals, I didn't think they could have for God.
Well, that's why you're not Cain or Hevel, I imagine. Because you don't have that initiative.
No.
What?
Yeah.
It's a sense of gratitude. Is more gratitude is expressed to a larger extent by, you know, bringing something as opposed to just paying lip service. It's very easy to say thank you. Less easy to actually give something over. So I imagine that's what they tried to do.
Really, giving them, it's like, here, I'm going to give you something, and then you're going to give it right back to me. No, wait, no, it was for you. But really, are we talking about giving it back to Hashem? Is that what we're talking about?
What do you mean Hashem gave it to us?
Well, here, you give the animals to take for your use, for your needs, right?
Yeah, but he, in the meantime, he asked for, you know, it's he added value to them, you know, like he grazed them and he grew them, right? So it's not just God's gift at this point. There's human endeavor in this as well.
Right.
As a matter of fact, to add to that, this is the first time there's human endeavor, right? Because Adam was off in here doing, you know, sitting in the rivers now, right? So this is the first time there's human endeavor, and they recognize that their added value to what God gave them is worthy to give God gratitude for having given them the capacity to add that on. I think that's what's going on.
I mean, should we look at it as a gift, or should we look at it, I mean, that's totally what I don't understand.
Are you asking a general question of Karbanos, which is a very fundamental question, which is a question that Ramban asked at the beginning of Vayikra. In other words, what good does it do to bring a Karban to God? How can you give a gift to God? Right? That's a very fundamental question, which is one of the basic questions that underlies the entire concept of sacrifices, which is a very good question, obviously. So I imagine that we can answer briefly, although really Ramban goes on for pages and pages, right? But just to answer briefly, Ramban says it's not really a gift in the sense of I give you something because you need it. Sometimes I give a gift as a sign of my love even though you don't need it at all. In fact, the greatest gifts of love are the most impractical, such as roses. Okay, I can't eat a rose. It's not even a rose, but somehow or another people are giving roses. What?
You don't really smell roses either.
They're much better smelling flowers.
You don't get my point.
But like it certainly is an idea that the gifts which are given are not given because of their practical value, but rather because they express something within me, right? So therefore, here too, the idea of karma, not just here, throughout Vayikra, is a person gives a karma as a means of expressing that which is within him. And the word karma, sacrifice, actually, doesn't translate in Hebrew into karma. The word sacrifice in English means when I, it's a good definition. I suffer in order to do something good for somebody else, right? In baseball, right? A sacrifice bunt, right? What happens if a person sacrifices? So he gives out his capacity to get a hit in order that the guy in front of him should advance the base. That's material selfish, right? He's giving all of his suffering in order to advance the guy before him, right? That's the term sacrifice. But in Hebrew, the word karma comes from one word?
Near,
karov, right, to come near. So it means actually, I'm being miskarev, I'm coming close to God by bringing the sacrifice. It's my expression of my desire to come close to God. And that's what, we don't have a lot of ceremony usually in the Beis HaMikdash, with all that stuff going on, in order that it should have that, sense of uplifting myself to God. Right. In general, I really should tell you more about the Ramban, because it's fascinating, Ramban. So I'm going to digress for a minute, okay? Just give me a minute here, okay? The Ramban actually has a big machlokes with the Ramban. The Ramban says that the reason why we're given the mitzvah of sacrifice is because the idolaters had mitzvah of sacrifice for themselves, obviously, right? The pagans were sacrificing left and right. And the Jews were killing themselves if they didn't have the framework of sacrifices. So therefore God said, I'll do you a favor, right? You guys like sacrifices in the old days, they didn't have television, they didn't have movies. So you guys like sacrifices, fine, I'll give you old sacrifices. And he gave them all Sefer Vayikra in order to, give them the concept of sacrifices. So the Ramban goes crazy on the Ramban. He says, what happened to possibly be? You say that the whole mitzvah of korbanos, the whole mitzvah of bringing sacrifices, is only like a stop to the human frailty to want to sacrifice, which is a shortcut. Pagans do it, right? So God is only giving this to them in order to make them not jealous, so to speak, of all the exciting pagan rituals which exist. So the Ramban doesn't like that at all. He says, of course, Karbanos have a value in and of themselves. He says the value is that they bring you closer to God by uplifting you together with the Karban as you behold it being done. You are too uplifted, especially if you consume it and you're engaged in it fully, so as holy, so brings you up. So what's the chat in the Rambam? The fact the Rambam seems very difficult. So the way they explain the Rambam is that the Rambam is not saying that because the pagans had the concept of sacrifices, therefore the Jews had a concept of sacrifices. Rather, he's saying there is a basic human trait which is embedded in the psyche and the soul of a human being. That a human being wants to do things which are extreme and passionate in order to demonstrate their connection to other things, right? It's not something which is specifically has to do with idolatry, but rather in idolatry we see manifest this human trait, it takes the form of sacrifices, right? So when God came to give the mitzvahs to the Jews, so he gave mitzvahs which cater to the totality of the human soul, the human psyche, everything which goes on. And in order to deal with that part of the human soul, which has this drive to participate in these ceremonies, which have all these connotations to them, and which take place with the sacrifice of an animal, all the things which have to do with the blood and all that kind of stuff. So God gave the mitzvah of korban. So again, it's not because they were jealous of the pagans, but rather because the pagan ritual reflected something deep within the human psyche which had to be developed. In general, I want to tell you again, in this respect, as well, sort of address a little bit more. All the mitzvahs are given in order to refine human beings, right? In order to refine all their traits. So therefore, most mitzvahs which are given in order to refine human kindness. Because kindness is a good thing, and we want people to be kind, so therefore the mitzvah stress being kind. Now, many, many of them. So we have a mitzvah of Shiruah Katan. The mitzvah, when you take the young birds or chicks which are in a nest, you're supposed to send away the mother bird, right? Anybody familiar with that mitzvah? Mm-hmm. One mitzvah at the end of the Torah. So the halacha is, again, the law is when you take the eggs or the chicks, you have to send away the mother bird first. So most of the interpretations of the mitzvah say that the mitzvah is also developing within a human being the trait of kindness, because the mother shouldn't see her children being taken away. So kind gesture. But the Gra, the Vilna Gaon, says the fact anything on this mitzvah. He says, and it says it's based on a Zohar somewhere, but it's, the Gra brings out the idea. He says there's a Zohar, which says, I don't know where it is, the Zohar probably is there in the Kitesa. The Zohar says that after the mother gets sent away, she gets very, very agitated. And she goes and casts herself on the rocks and commits suicide. So what kind of kindness is this? Is the mother bird going to go and commit suicide as a result, right? So the Gra says it's not a kindness. He says the mitzvah of Shiruah Hakan, the mitzvah of the family of the mother bird, is a mitzvah to be cruel. And if God gave human beings, endowed them with the trait of cruelty, that means that in some way, shape, or form, that trait is necessary, whatever purpose, right? We can imagine purposes in cases in which cruelty is essential. So since cruelty is a necessary part of the human condition, so therefore Hashem had to give at least one mitzvah in which cruelty can be developed in a holy and positive way. And this mitzvah which he gave is this mitzvah to send away the mother bird. Now why am I saying this? Because it's part of this idea of the Rambam. The idea of the Rambam is that all human traits have elements in which they are positive and are necessary in order to make up the human condition. The Rambam says two which are difficult to develop properly, which therefore one should avoid, are anger and pride. But all the rest of them, besides anger and pride, everything the Rambam agrees, they have to be developed in a positive way, using the context which God wanted them. So therefore, those traits which are developed by Korbanos, just like those traits of cruelty which are developed by Shiruah Hashem, are brought out by Korbanos, and that's why God gave that mitzvah. Okay, so that's how I would add to the Rambam. Yeah.
Is there any halachic authority or Torah authority for the proposition that you got animal sacrifice in order to lead humanity away from human sacrifice? That is, it was a way to lead hope away from the human sacrifice.
It's unlikely, because here we have the first sacrifice before there was any human sacrifice. So it's Cain and Hevel, specifically Hevel, is bringing his carbon here before his first carbon. It was not even sacrifice at this point.
But God knew it was going to be human sacrifice, so maybe he was setting up a preventive measure.
I don't know. Could be. I mean, but it's unlikely. It doesn't seem to work out in terms of who was sacrificing when. Since there are many great people who are sacrificing before it was given, it doesn't seem that it was because it was in lieu of human sacrifice, but it seems that people who did it because it was an end in and of itself. Yeah, maybe we'll
like animal, how much better is
yeah.
Few questions.
One is,
how do we know which animal
is sacrificed? We don't. We assume it's from the sheep, since he was a shepherd.
So the
shepherd is a little ass son. Well, it could be goats, sheep, one of those types of animals, usually. It's not usually cattle. Okay. But you're right, whatever animal he was shepherding.
Yeah, which one would you choose, and why would you choose, what? What animals would you choose to sacrifice?
Well, it says here the best one. I don't know you choose the best sheep. I don't know what defines the best sheep. Okay. But you chose the one with the best lamb chops.
Right. So how does Cain offer?
I imagine that somehow either he made a fire and put whatever food on the fire, or he libated. So he made wine or juice out of it, and then libated, poured that, down on the ground or in front or after fire and said, this is for the purpose of God. I don't think anybody tells us exactly how it works. Not clear to somebody.
Well, how does the fruit offering in the temple work?
Well, there they were brought as either in the form of flour, mostly, or in the form of wine. They were known, which you couldn't just bring a fruit and put it on top of the altar. They poured into holes on top of the altar. They were holes. No. They fall through. Specific holes for that purpose. Yeah?
No, I have the need of liberation rather than the idea of God's sinners because it's a necessary thing because of the human creation and something like that. But if it would be necessary, then we would have the need that actually to go and do it. But we don't have the need that to go and do it. We have the need that in the case.
So doesn't that teach you something about cruelty?
Yeah, it teaches that you gotta control it.
It teaches that
it is necessary.
It teaches you that you should not be cruel unless it's absolutely necessary. You shouldn't seek out opportunities to be cruel. Isn't that obvious?
Exactly.
So?
But why? It's not because human...
Oh, you're not asking a question, making a statement.
I am disagreeing with that because a human is not inherently cruel because it's not in the amoeba to do it.
The means a human being has the capacity to be cruel. And the Torah says, you know what, you shouldn't go out of your way to be cruel. Don't look for opportunities to be cruel. But you have to be capable when the necessity arises of being cruel. The Gemara says, of course, that anybody who is cruel to evil people, right, call him a rachim al achzor, anybody who is merciful to cruel people, Selfo not the achzor, in the end it will become cruel, with rachmonim on the merciful people. So therefore, to people who are cruel, you have to be cruel. For people who are merciful, you have to be merciful. But you're not supposed to look specifically for it. I'm turning around what you're saying. You're not supposed to look specifically for opportunities to be cruel and nasty to people. Rather, sometimes it's necessary to do. So you have to be ready for those rare occasions where the opportunity or the necessity, I should say, arises to be able to do it again.
What are some of those unusual circumstances where it's necessary to be cruel?
When you're fighting a war. When you have enemies, which you have to deal with.
Yeah.
When you have people who are...
I don't see why that's cruel.
Oh, stabbing someone in the head? Yeah, I don't know. You don't have to torture them in order to be cruel. Killing them is probably pretty cruel. You know, if you take a sinner and you stone them, sounds like a pretty cruel thing to do. So I would say that, you know, the Torah says many times that you have to be prepared to punish the evildoers, to smite them down, and therefore that requires...
Lying is cruel.
I think so.
Or torture them for information?
We don't usually torture. I mean, it's not... Torah never advises
you to torture. You have somebody to know where your friends, and you start hitting them or something. That's cool.
Right,
but there are limits. You couldn't torture somebody, even though it might be advantageous in the battle.
I'm not so sure about that. That's a big question in modern Israeli ethics. When they have a terrorist, which they take captive, and they know they can extort information from him only by torture, whether they're allowed to torture him or not. And the Israeli Supreme Court, I think justifiably so, said moderate torture is allowed.
Well,
not what?
Lack of sleep and water.
Yeah, whatever it was.
Water on him or something.
Yeah, so it's not, you know, they can't take out his fingernails and break him on the rack. But they can actually, they are allowed to do things to compel information. So, of course, everything has limits, but I'm not so sure I would make a blanket statement that no torture is permitted. You know, I think that one has to be reasonable. You know, of course, since there's a mitzvah not to tar al chayim, not to cause anguish to animals, there's certainly a mitzvah not to cause anguish to human beings. But, on the other hand, when necessary, we do kill animals. So, when necessary, I assume we do cause human beings anguish in order to extract important information from them. So I wouldn't categorically reject torture, at least not offhand. I know that sounds
but
radical.
You might categorically reject extreme torture.
Yeah, well, extreme torture we categorically reject, right? The question is where you draw the line.
Yeah.
Okay, who had their hand up before?
I did.
Yes. Finished? Yeah.
I have a quick
sure.
Could it be that after it came... Notice that
Havel's
sacrifice was accepted.
You
tried offering his brother.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory.
Because then he says, doesn't he say, "Am I my brother's keeper?" Like, kind of like, "Am I my brother's shepherd?"
It's an interesting theory, but it sounds. I mean, we're pretty far away from that puzzle. It's gonna take us a while to get there. But it sounds like what?
Are we two lines, two verses?
No. I mean, look how many lines there is in the Chumash. No, you're right, it's two verses, three verses away, but it's a lot of lines. No, that's actually more than that. It is in Pasuk Ches, and we're in Pasuk Dalet right now. But yet, what? It could be, right? It's certainly a theory which could come up naturally as a result of our conversation. The question is whether the psukim between this Pasuk and that Pasuk will sustain it. That's all I have to say. Anybody else? Okay, so the let's see what the Malbim has to say on these two psukim.
Right.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Sometimes I have this confusion that we are
thinking
about
Adam, the Garden of Eden, and we are talking about one brother sacrificing their brother. I mean, it sounds very deep to me.
So talk to him. I
didn't
say he said it.
No, he said it. He said it. Of course, he said it. It's possible. I mean, I mean, I just think we are sometimes thinking all these people are seeing cannibals, and they were like.
No, cannibals at least they ate each other.
I mean, we could say that in a moment, but I think these were like pretty big people. I don't think they were sacrificing each other.
By the way, it's an interesting question. Once you bring it up, it's an interesting question how long years ago, when I was a member of the Bnei Akiva Youth Movement, one of the standard, I must have been in an activity like this several times because it sticks in my mind, one of the standard topics for discussion was, let's say you are in stranded in in the Andes Mountains, where something like this actually happens, and you only can survive by either eating, eating human flesh or eating animal flesh. The humans are dead; you didn't kill them. Right? But you only survive by eating human flesh or animal flesh. Which should you eat? Because according to strict Torah law, why is this such an exciting topic? Besides the gore involved, because according to strict Torah law. It's a more severe prohibition to eat from an animal which is not kosher or not slaughtered properly than it is to eat human flesh.
Is human flesh an animal, though?
What? No, human being is not an animal. There's no...
The physical part is an animal.
No, but it's not considered... In the Torah, it's not considered one of the animals. So therefore, there is a prohibition, a law, a negative command in the Torah, to eat animals which are not slaughtered properly or to eat animals which are not kosher, of course. But there's no prohibition that's put in the Torah to eat human flesh.
Dead.
You know, what?
Dead.
Dead human flesh.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
For sure.
The flesh of dead humans. Okay. Yeah. So which should you choose? Right? That's the question. So there is a correct answer for this. Right? The correct answer is that there's another prohibition in the Torah, which is Baal Teshachsu. You're not allowed to do certain things which are disgusting and repugnant, right? Obviously all human beings find to be abominable. Good word. So therefore, that law would apply to eating human flesh. That prohibition, right? So that's how you get out of it. But in the meantime, there's a lot of topics. So there's a lot of room for conversation and exciting debate on the topic.
Is that a progressive notion? That is, what's disgusting and abominable changes over time.
I don't think it should change. I think it always is like this. That's why the Torah never gave a prohibition to eat human flesh. It wasn't necessary. Because human beings naturally refrain from eating human flesh because it's abominable to them.
Well, 2,000 years ago.
Okay, yeah. Well, there are exceptions to every rule. But, yeah.
2,000 years ago, it was neither disgusting nor abominable to have slaves. Today, we wouldn't
okay, now it's different, because we're talking about here, there's low bouncing shots that do with your physical contact with something, not with specific practices. You can't apply that as a blanket tool to all practices that you want to forbid. Okay, get what I'm saying? In other words, you're not allowed to eat, ingest, or come into contact with things which are physically
abominable. Eating rule.
Right,
so
abominable
cultural, eating. It's more cultural than it is for, it's the application, like it's part. Parties are like the only grasshoppers
that I understand
or something like that, right?
Right.
So that's
going to
be both.
Only locusts, not grasshoppers. Right. No, okay, it could be about the shop.
Which is good.
Right. Well, true, it could be cultural. Yeah. But it's not slavery, slavery wouldn't apply to that.
There's not something
happening
anymore. Isn't like a lower
punishment
for that than
eating animal flesh? Not
necessarily.
Just
what's the punishment for that?
I don't know. It could be a prohibition as well, because we have to define the law and have Aiden, witnesses. What?
Not sure that
I'm eating an unkosher
animal.
The same thing. It's a law. Not sorry. Chelo is a kosher, not just a regular unkosher animal. If you go and have a Big Mac, It's only susceptible to flogging. Only lashes, right.
There are other applications,
yeah.
Like what you said before, when you take it out of the context of what you're saying. Like, I don't know about that now. But there are,
okay.
The rule does apply to other things that are considered abominable practices.
Okay, it may well be. All right, fine. Yeah.
I heard from my rabbi when I was in Israel that it's worth to eat vegetables which aren't tithed or kosher than it is to eat meat. Why? Because on vegetables that aren't properly done under supervision, you're going to have animals, creatures on your life.
No, it's not to do with the
insects. No, because of the insects.
To do with the insects.
Yeah, to do with the insects. Because if you're eating an insect, it's not kosher, it's a non-kosher animal. In which case it's more of a sin for you to eat the vegetables than if you to eat the actual meat.
Right, because you're eating many little animals.
Mm.
Not because it's not because of the vegetable. But the vegetable part you're eating...
I'm not familiar with the true thing, right?
Yeah, but it's not because it's true. But it's not because of the vegetable that it's true, right? It's because of the creepy crawly thing around the vegetable.
So in which case does that mean that we shouldn't be buying any vegetables? I'm sure that vegetables on top of
you should be able to check that.
You know how many
In America, usually on iceberg lettuce and other kinds of lettuce, that sort of aren't problems, and many people don't check it. But romaine lettuce has to be checked. Broccoli is an issue, and the worst vegetable they say is Brussels sprouts. I have not had Brussels sprouts in many years because they say that Brussels sprouts are infected with bugs. And that it is impossible to check and remove the bugs from them.
I thought if you can't see the bugs, then they're considered a copy and they're controlling the current on a human level.
Yes, but I think that they are visible. It's just that it's not. It's a very big pain to overlook for them, yeah. So there's so many layers in the crowd. What? You're not allowed to. So then you're allowed to. That's where Heather, we're really getting far afield here. But once we're on the topic, the halacha is that you're not allowed. One of the major problems is spinach. Spinach is a big problem. Spinach has lots of bugs in it. But, so you can't buy fresh spinach, fresh spinach leaves, unless it comes with hashgacha or you check it yourself. It comes with hashgacha. If somebody is claiming to have checked it along the way. So if it doesn't come with hashgacha, you have to check it yourself. However, if you go to the supermarket and you want to buy chopped frozen spinach, then you can buy chopped frozen spinach without a hechsher. Why? What's the logic of that? Because the logic is, you don't know if their bugs are there. And even if the bugs are there, maybe they were chopped up by the blades. Right? Why is that better if they're chopped up by the blades? Because a whole bug, even if it's dead, it's not butter. It's not nullified by a majority of other substances. Because anything, a whole entity of any sort is not nullified. This thing when you learn the first Michal, you will learn, Dayan Yes Hashem, that the whole things are not nullified in a mixture. But bug particles, that's a story, bug particles are nullified in a mixture. So therefore, if the leaves are chopped, like the chopped spinach comes in the package, or chopped broccoli, the same idea, then you can actually buy it because you can assume that at least there's a sulfate that these things were actually chopped up, right? Chopped up in the course. So it's really a suffix. I should make it clear. Normally, we don't rely on a suffix in a suffix in a question where it's a suffix in a zoraisa, in a Torah law. But on a Torah law, even a whole bug can be nullified by the majority of spinach with which they're mixed. By a rabbinic law, they can't be nullified because they're a whole bug. The rabbi said whole bugs and other stuff that's sort of not nullified. But there's a doubt. But there's a doubt now in the rabbinic law. Perhaps they have been chopped up. But since it's possible they've been chopped up, because the whole thing has been chopped, so therefore it's a doubt in a rabbinic law, and a doubt in a rabbinic law, one is entitled to be legal. Okay? That's why chopped broccoli, chopped spinach, depends how finely it's chopped, but you can buy it without hashgacha.
That's why we say peanut butter. They say peanut butter contains a lot of bugs mixed in it, and it's possible to plant. They can crawl in there. And actually, they were actually allowed by the FDA to specifically put in bug cards to add more protein or something.
No, they're cool.
Yeah.
They heard how much is allowed.
And, how much is allowed, but some companies, they make sure that much of that is allowed is actually in
there. Like a cigarette maker spiking nicotine, you're saying you're spiking our peanut butter with bugs.
Well, all people are going to some, or at least.
Sorry, you're
And so
which company?
Chopped up. I don't know which one.
It's also true about honey. Because honey, if you think about it, honey is, has a lot of bee parts in it. So therefore, you know, we assume that those bee parts are, they don't hold bees in honey usually. So you don't find a whole bee in the honey, so therefore, even their small legs and stuff and the antennae, you don't have to be worried about that.
All of honey comes from bees?
All honey comes from bees?
Isn't it? They make it. They make what?
Yeah.
How do honey make honey?
Bees
do it. They
take the pollen and they like do stuff with it in their body and then they...
That's what you're asking.
Well, because...
Are you asking why honey is kosher?
Yeah,
I ask the same question.
That's
the Gemara B'Choros asked that question. Gemara B'Choros says that the... What? Milk from non-kosher animals is not permitted either. You can't have pig milk. So what question... The Gemara does ask that question about honey. How come honey is permitted if it's produced by non-kosher animals? So the non-kosher insect. So the Gemara... I don't remember exactly what the Gemara says. The Gemara learns from a puzzle somewhere that food is permitted because somebody was eating honey. That's fake honey. That's honey. But somebody was eating honey somewhere. I think Yonasan in Sefer Shmuel. But in any event, and then it says that the process of making honey, and I don't know the biology, but the process by which a bee makes honey is not the same process as, say, how an animal makes milk. In other words, there's a much more direct connection between the pollen and stuff which comes in and the honey which flows out than there is between the feed which, say, a camel or a pig takes in and the milk which comes out the other side. So therefore, it's considered to be like just passing through as opposed to actually being created.
I don't think they should go into the body. I think they might... Get on it or something, do something to make it into honey.
Okay, whatever happens, it's not the same process. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm
sure Abel sacrificed bees. Yeah.
Do animals eat their own species?
Some do, I think. The stories about insects where the female eats the male.
Female eats the male.
Okay. Let's be pragmatic. Let's be realistic about this. I mean, once Cain took over the farming, Hevel had to find some way to sustain himself. So therefore, what was left is the grain of sheep. You're asking what? What? I'm saying they want to split apart. You know, that's what, until the Tower of Babel, human beings had the tendency to not spread apart, but rather to come together, live in close union. So therefore, nobody wanted to go and become, you know, let's try to move to Russia.
Yeah. Cain was born first. That
was that he began using the realm before. Well, but according to the rabbis, they were twins. Mm-hmm. Cain was the first one to come out, but they were twins. So, it wasn't that much older.
You had, like, 7 kids
come out
at one time. Did they?
They were twins, and they had twin wives. 5 kids.
Five kids,
sorry. So it says that the Jews had Mitzrayim at 6 or 7 kids. It's
Four women.
Sorry. Yeah.
Children to one.
Yeah. Was that case in Iowa? Septuplets? Wasn't that
recent?
Yeah,
it was a recent case.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
So that's
a septuplet. 7 kids.
Yeah.
How did you do it?
With great difficulty, I'm sure, but it succeeded.
Another one. It looks like a dog. It's a form of their litter.
Yes.
Okay, Cain, yes, good man, does that, what Adam was doing, does what he's supposed to do. He seems like he should be kind of like a light guy. Kind of just a bad man, doesn't really do that. Why, in retrospect, he looked at it and gave it to me, it was that guy.
We just got in yesterday. In our time frame, it's going to take us about a week to get to that, the answer to that question. So we move very slowly here. We digress a lot. The fast or the slow one. Okay, so the I want to go again through the Malbim on these verses, as we always do. So it says, the Malbim says about verse 3 and verse 4, that the Torah tells us how the Cain and Hevel were aroused by themselves to bring these sacrifices. Right? God didn't tell them to bring the sacrifices. Who pointed that out here before? A bunch of people, right? And he says, in line of what we said before, that the nature of a human being is to recognize that there are higher levels in this world, things which are higher and higher, and the highest thing is the Creator, and the soul of a human being has a natural tendency to volunteer, in other words, to try and devote something of his own to give gratitude for God's favors and to demonstrate his submission and thanks by bringing the sacrifice. And he brings down a pasuk in Tehillim, which seems to indicate that that's the tendency, that's the trend. But he says, okay, they both had the tendency. They both wanted to come towards God of their human nature. But he says there are four differences between the carbon of Cain and the carbon of Abel. Four differences. First of all, he says, Cain did not recognize that God is the cause of everything and the end goal of everything, so that everything should really... Actually, every human success really relates back to God. Cain only thought that God assists people in the process, right? And actually, God and nature assists the person in the process. So therefore, he brought the mincha at the end, not seems the way he learned the puzzle, not when he could have immediately, but rather at the end of the process, meaning he could have, the moment they left the Garden of Eden, he could have brought a bottle and said, well, I'm very happy, I'm not very happy. I have this great drive to connect to God, let me be in Corbin. But he only actually thanks him at the end of the process. At the end of the process, the Malbim contends, is because his recognition of God was not that the God causes everything, and therefore you should immediately bring him a sacrifice, but rather if God helps you out along the way, then at the end of the process, give him some thanks. Right? So not at the beginning, but at the end. That's the way the Malbim wants to learn it. Okay, it's an interesting idea. And he wants to claim that Hevel, on the other hand, even though he doesn't see that brought his sacrifice any earlier, but he did recognize that God is the first cause of everything, and that's why he brought the firstborn of the sheep, the Becholos, right? So I don't know why he didn't bring the sheep right at the beginning, but the first time a sheep was born, that was immediately he brought that. So he recognized that the first cause of everything is from God. Okay? So that, and that's why in fact we are commanded to bring all the firstborns, whether it's the firstborns of animals or the first fruits of the tree, to God, to the temple, as sacrifices or to give to the priests. That's what the modern mitzvah is doing. Now, the second thing which the rabbis say, this is the Malbim's own idea, that Hevel brought at the end of the process, and Hevel brought from the beginning, the firstborn of this process. The second idea is that Cain brought from not the best. He didn't bring the best stuff. If you look in here in the article says, brings down here from...
brought an offering.
Excuse me?
It says Cain brought an offering.
Right, so it says here in the article on the bottom of page 20, on top page 21, from the subtle contrast between the simple description of Cain's offering and the more specific description of Abel's offering, from the firstlings of his stock and from their choices, the sages derive that Cain's offering was from the inferior portions of the crop, while Abel chose only the finest of his flock. And that's why the Abel sacrifice was accepted and not Cain. Yeah?
If Cain was a dealer in the ground, then definitely he has to wait to the last point, because usually the fruits or the water, the vegetables, or whatever, the operas in the best days when they grow and reach a certain point. But still, on the other way, he was going to offer an animal. The animal is not the best when it's about to die, but just in the middle. So, I mean, Cain was waiting for the best time, not because he forgot, because he didn't want to do it right.
They're really trying to defend Cain here. But besides, he said that,
I think that a bird who works the ground is much more recognized, much more the word of Hashem, because of the faith he needs to work the ground rather than work an animal, which animals do things like himself. And you, there's no interaction. And if you have to work the ground, it's
that's true. The Gemara says that farmers demonstrate greater trust and belief in God by, you know, they're planting the seeds and expecting it to grow. Yes. But nevertheless, what the commentaries here are saying is that the Torah is very elaborate in its description of Hevel's Korbanos, right? And it's very terse and very brief about Cain's Korban, right? From the fruit of the ground. So therefore, it's clear, even if you don't accept the other aspects of what the Malvim and the other commentaries say, clearly the Torah is alluding to Hevel's Korban as being the better Korban, as being done with more devotion and greater dedication, because it was a nicer thing. All right, those are two differences. We'll have to see the other two differences tomorrow. Tomorrow we do have a class, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Not Sunday, right?
Sunday.
Okay.
I'll be here Sunday.
I don't think I'm Friday anyway, so it's not relevant to me.
That's so good. I'm going to be
here. He does punch up the two sacrifices. Hevel did have my elaborate one.